tonight, I hope to share with you a lesson from early in my investment career to try and tease out a point that's relevant for investing. I also hope to touch on the current state of play globally regarding economies, policies from all the way from interest rate policies to government spending policies. And I hope to introduce a concept that we've been investing in the products that I run at Milford, to give you shed some light, give you a snapshot of how we're investing and what type of companies we're investing in. So I'll start with, I hope this is the clicker. Right, it's the usual customary disclaimer, the highlights. So this is not financial advice. If you need financial advice, you should speak with an advisor, which Milford has a cohort of. The customary slides about the company I work for, Milford. Again, I'm not going to spend a lot of time here, but just to emphasize, we are a staff-owned company. We manage about $9 billion New Zealand dollars now, which is a decent size and growing. And we have a substantial investment, members of staff, shareholders of the company, with substantial investments in Milford products alongside our clients. I'll be remiss to not mention our values, which I hold very dearly, including personal integrity, driving for excellence. We pride ourselves on the returns we can generate for our customers, but also the service we provide. We invest in the best people, that's probably excluding myself. But also, we have a very strong culture of broad-based staff participation in the equity of the company. Last slide on the firm. We are a responsible member of the investing community. We've joined two associations, one an Australasian association, one a global association. It means we screen out which are pretty egregiously negative products, such as cluster bombs, nuclear weapons, tobacco. We do not invest in those. We also incorporate considerations for the environment, for social impact and corporate governance when we invest in companies, and we will vote all proxies. Now, on to my first part. What I've called for false knowns, but it hopefully will be obvious by the end of this section. I'm going to start with where I began as an investor in London, 2004. I joined a firm that was a stone's throw away from Buckingham Palace, then that's why I included this. The company was founded by three former Goldman Sachs employees, one of which was a very senior partner who managed Goldman Sachs, the famous Wall Street firms, is private investments in the whole of Europe. So a very impressive CV the founder had. And he invested about $40, $30 million of his own money in the fund. And the fund was seeded by two particularly notable seed investors. One was the family office of George Soros, American investor, you can call him, that is famous for breaking the pound back in the 80s for betting against the Bank of England. The second seed investor is a UK-based investor back in the day called Joe Lewis, who happens to also own a stake in Tottenham Hotspur, just to make a reference to a company that's notable. But both of them were reasonably high profile and very capable investors that seeded our fund. And as a young graduate joining as an analyst, I thought, wow, what a fantastic opportunity to learn from some of the brightest people with great resumes. You know, George Soros, surely he can just turn water into gold. And Joe Lewis, you know, famed investor, you know, self-made billionaire, started off buying pubs in London, in the East End of London. Surely nothing can go wrong here. And here's Uncle Joe himself. In around 2007, being a value investor, running into the global financial crisis, that was 2006 to 2008, had many temptations. One of which was we saw banks suddenly, because U.S. housing markets has started to turn. In fact, U.S. house prices started falling as early as 2006. There were bank companies which were trading quite cheap to a value investor that appeared pretty attractive, not least because one of our backers in the fund, Mr. Uncle Joe, he himself invested $1 billion of his own money in buying a 10% stake in this company called Bear Stearns that will fail ahead of the more high-profile failure that is going to be Lehman Brothers. But this was 2007, and the founders of the fund I was working for had no issue following Uncle Joe into this trade. Before you know it, Ben Bernanke, the then U.S. Federal Reserve Chairman in the U.S., came out with a rather comforting statement. So this is still in the middle of 2007. We think the economy is going to recover in the second half of 2007. In fact, we think it's going to grow moderately by 2008. And I think we all know, subsequent to this, with hindsight, how wrong that was. But he wasn't the only one that was wrong. Jim Cramer is a financial celebrity, I guess, if you watch U.S. Cable TV. He's on CNBC. Used to be an investor himself, but now, obviously, very high profile, and still is a very high profile financial commentator. And in the month of March 2008, the fateful month that Bear Stearns will effectively go bankrupt, the week before the precipitous fall, he was quoted, it was asked on live TV what he thought about the shares of Bear Stearns. And for such a well-connected person sitting in New York, you would think he may have had an inkling that something was awry. But no, he said, do not take your money out of Bear Stearns. We think it's going to be fine. And in fact, for my fund at the time, we were still buying shares in Bear Stearns at about 60, 70 US dollars a share the week before that there was going to be an announcement, effectively a rescue, a bailout by JP Morgan with the help of the US Federal Reserve. So at no point during this process did the very smart people I was working with really question, could we be wrong here? Did Uncle Joe really do his homework that we all assumed he did when he committed $1 billion? And here's where I start to think back to a famous, well, probably infamous at the time, but now probably famous, 2002 quote by the then U.S. Secretary of Defense, Donald Rumsfeld, the famous quote around knowns and unknowns. And without going into the mental acrobat, I'm going to tell you the truth is there's a lot of unknowns. There's a lot that we don't know. So I spend the rest of my then career up till now thinking about what are these unknowns? Well, one of which clearly is a black swan event akin to the COVID pandemic that we're currently still in the midst of. Not many investors would have, at the end of last year, thought, well, this could be a relevant scenario, but yet here we are. So that's clearly one type of unknown. Another type of unknown, as I alluded to earlier, perhaps it's a false known. It's a known that you thought you were pretty certain on because there are people collaborating, there's smart people, and you're investing on the back of someone else's opinion, so you've implicitly trusted the work they have done, but did they actually do the work? Maybe one of the unknowns is just a known that's just not true. So my first message to you as retail investors, individual investors, is when investing, especially during times of uncertainty, is do take risk. There's no point in investing if you're not going to take risk. But be humble. There's a huge amount of unknowns, some which are, you know, possible, some are improbable but could still happen. Nobody knows. I don't know. Ben Bernanke didn't know. Jim Cramer didn't know. My first boss didn't know. Value investing is a second sub-point I want to mention. I grew up reading the books of Benjamin Graham, The Intelligent Investor Security Analysis, buying companies for net working capital only, you know, very cheap without regards for the fixed assets of a company. But what I found with Bear Stearns in 2007, 2008 was there were a lot of cheap companies trading on low PEs, low price to book. Bear Stearns was trading on 0.8 times book the week before it subsequently went to $2. So I don't think value investing is about buying just low PE multiples, even though if that may be convenient. I'm going to be slightly controversial here with my third point. I don't think volatility or uncertainty is a particular problem. When you're uncertain, you don't overcommit, you're not overconfident about your views. You tend to operate in a space that's risk averse. You're balancing risk rewards. Your calculator, your brain is thinking when there's uncertainty. And another way to put it is, if what I'm proposing to you is dead certain, how much money do you think you can make from that venture? Probably not a lot. So I think when it comes to investing, this perception that volatility is bad, uncertainty is problematic, I think is certainly an opportunity in that. And a final point on this part is, I genuinely think we can do well investing from New Zealand. And not only in New Zealand companies, which is more obvious, but also in international companies. Because we do our own work. We simply can't rely on the inside track or the friendly tip from another well-known investor. We have to think for ourselves. In fact, that often pushes us towards thinking about more important, longer-term issues. And we don't have the home bias. I mean, all you have to look at some of these UK managers who are supposedly global investors, and often you find a disproportionate amount of their holding is still in UK businesses. We simply don't have enough New Zealand businesses for that to play here when in an international portfolio. But again, there are advantages to investing from New Zealand in global equities.
Sorry to interrupt. If you enjoy this content, make sure you subscribe so you do not miss the next one, and hit this like button to let me know that you want more information like this. Thank you.
Now, I want to touch on a point that is relevant when investing, and that is what I call the prevailing winds. You got to know where you're at in terms of the economic cycle, in terms of policies that can impact financial assets. The first point to say is a pretty obvious one, is that despite how well New Zealand has done containing the virus, best estimates by experts at this moment for 2020, this year, is that our economy is still likely to shrink about 5%, mid-single digit. As a island nation, we have contained it well, but we can't really capitalize on how well we've contained it. That's because a lot of our economy is still dependent on other countries, tourism, exports, and the likes. And to put that into perspective, the U.S. economy, based on current estimates, is expected to shrink 5.5%. So very similar, even though the U.S. hasn't done anywhere near as well as we have in terms of containing the virus, being responsible citizens. China, on the other hand, is expected to grow 2%, even though that's arguably where the virus originated from and was hit early. Europe, down 8%. So the situation is pretty grave. We don't usually have that many countries that broad of a negative economic activity picture. And this is just a convenient chart that sums up 7 different inputs, including unemployment, industrial activity, consumer confidence, company earnings, financial markets, health of financial markets, to give you an illustration of how deep and sudden this drop-off has been. And it's certainly comparable if you simply looked at statistics to 2007, 2008, the last financial crisis. But here's the silver lining. This chart shows a long-term study, 50 years worth of data, showing GDP, economic growth, along the bottom, and then the share markets of that country's returns on the vertical axis. And the first point you say is, well, this is a mess. This is not a nice chart. I can't draw a straight line through it. And in fact, that's exactly right. There is no correlation. There is no correlation between in-country, so an in-period economic growth and share market returns. And you should be happy that's the case, because to my earlier point, we're seeing an unprecedented period where our economic activities dip very quickly, but many people puzzle over why is our share markets up. And here is actually pretty good academic studies grounding for why that may be the case. And if you think about it, it's pretty intuitive. Markets look forward, right? So if you're in country, in period, so just for example, 2018 to 2020, so this two-year period, if our economic growth is high, should you expect our share markets performance to be high? Maybe, but the share markets right now is really thinking about next year. So the tagline here is that markets predict economies. Economies don't predict markets. There's nothing to fear by the simple fact that we are in a pretty disastrous low point in terms of economic growth in the context of an investor. And here's where I transition a little bit away from economies, government spending that has been very helpful, towards monetary policy or interest rate setting. Here is Jerome Powell, the current US Federal Reserve Chairman, gesturing something small. Here is Christine Lagarde, the chairlady at the European Central Bank, again gesturing something very small, and I wonder what that is. Philip Lowe across the ditch, a Reserve Bank of Australia, again gesturing something very small. Our own Adrian Orr, Reserve Bank of New Zealand, gesturing something very small. And that is, of course, the interest you get on cash, on deposits. There has been a very consistent decrease in policy rates around the world, especially during COVID. Back in March, the US Federal Reserve cut 50 basis points a time, twice. And this is very relevant. And in fact, they're not only just cutting interest rates, they're actually printing money to use that digital money to buy assets like government bonds. Too much detail on this slide, but I would just point your attention to how the US Federal Reserve is mentioned, European Central Bank's mentioned, the Bank of Japan, BOJ, is mentioned. That's pretty coordinated, all the major developed economies. And what they're buying? Government bonds, money market securities, which basically mean very short-term debt issues, sometimes by corporations, longer-dated corporate bonds, a bit more adventurous. You know, government bonds, pretty safe. The moment you buy the debt of a corporate, of a company, there's a bit more risk involved. But they don't stop there. They even buy what they call Main Street facilities, potentially buying, you know, mortgages, lending or buying loans of private companies, so not even debt that's been issued in a securitized with documentation type form, but also buying loans. And the Japanese are buying real estate investment trusts, which basically means buildings, commercial buildings in a lot of cases. So that's pretty coordinated. And it's unprecedented. It's pretty powerful. So much so that when these plans were announced around this time, in response, in a very quick response to the situation we were witnessing where lockdowns were literally just shutting off economies immediately, that is reversed the stress that the market saw. Stress that was, loosely speaking, comparable to 2008, but responded with such haste that we're now back here, almost normal conditions. And remnants of the effects of such policies is that we have about $15 trillion worth of debt borrowings trading at negative interest rates. And that is about 23% of global bonds. And the bigger statistic is that 90% of global bonds now trade with an interest rate of 1% or less. That's very low by all accounts. And if you take inflation away, you're going to almost certainly end in negative territory. If you take tax away, which you have to pay on income, again, that takes it even more negative. Well, in the form of government spending, absolutely right. So one piece of information I've skipped over when talking about global economies is that governments around the world, along with central bankers, are doing everything they can to save jobs, to bridge people over, tie people over, even sending them checks to the tune of a double-digit percentage of respective economies. That's pretty significant. That's already in play, and there could be more. Here is a chart to illustrate this tug of war between should I buy a bond, which is nice and safe, or do I buy equities? This is a US-based chart. The idea is that, let's say the PE of the market is 20, you invert that PE, you get 5% earnings yield for equities. That 5% subtract current yield on a government bond is about 1%, so you get sort of 4-ish. And that's more or less what it's showing, that the equities are relatively attractive purely in terms of yield compared to government bonds. So here's a graphical representation of how I feel about the markets, given the help that governments around the world is basically giving and tying people over, staving off unemployment. And you add on top of that what central bankers are doing, you get this. Pretty bullish, just on the basis of analysis. Again, I remind you, it has nothing to do with the current level of economic activity. It has everything to do with the future, and the future is somewhat dictated by the policies that are currently in place. So back to my sort of summaries, my rolling summary slide. What's my second message to you is don't fight policy. Don't fight the Fed is a common sort of US saying. And to a lesser extent, don't fight coordinated global government spending because they're pretty hell-bent on keeping things up. So the last part of my talk, I'm going to give you a bit of a look into how we invest within Milford for global equities, some of our thoughts around how to win, how to be rewarding when investing. So I call this play the long game. So to my earlier first part of the talk is, I don't believe there's necessarily any advantages of information or inside track by being based outside New Zealand. And this is sort of the flip side of that coin. When we're based here, we've got to play the long game. We've got to think about what's likely to work and continue to work for the medium term. Here's a piece of academic study that I think is seminal, is pivotal, that's just come out in the last 2 years, courtesy of powerful computers to which to do the number crunching, but also turning past data into a digital form allowed this piece of research to happen. It's a research that's based on 30 years, loosely speaking, 30 years of stock price, share price returns. in multiple countries. In fact, there are 62,000 individual companies' share prices incorporated in this study. And there's some US shares, there's some non-US shares. The US shares in blue, non-US shares in red, but they're basically identical, right? To a naked eye, you wouldn't be able to tell the difference between a US line and a non-US line. And this particular chart shows you annual returns, one-year returns. So over 30 years, loosely speaking, 30 years of discrete one-year, single-year returns. The first thing I would say is, good news for equity investors. The most you can lose is only 100% of your money. You cannot lose more than what you've put in. Don't worry about it. Okay. The next thing to notice in terms of one-year returns, the most popular outcome for owning a share over 1 year is zero. Vast majority of cases, whatever you hold in your own account will go nowhere. That's the statistics. Now, individual companies will vary. Some companies will do better than others. But most companies, the median company or the mediocre company, the average company, does nothing. That's sitting right on top of the zero line. But then you look at the right-hand side of this curve. The most you can lose is 100. But there are companies out there that you can make 300, 400, and more. So this is a shorthand. In fact, there are some companies way out here, but they just have to stop the chart somewhere. That is a phenomenal advantage for share investors, if you didn't know already. That the most you can lose is 100, but the most you can gain, well, is unlimited, actually. But this piece of research just shows you graphically something that we as professional investors were well aware of, even though sometimes we couldn't even quite, even for us, think about how rewarding, how extraordinary this opportunity is to own a company that ends up producing that type of multiple returns. This second one is a follow-on to the first chart. But rather than showing you one-year returns, I'm going to show you 10-year returns, so longer term. Same data set, I just carved it up in bigger chunks. Rather than 31-year returns and then pulling them as a statistics, I've effectively looked at three distinct periods of 10-year returns. Let's go through this chart again. What's the first thing you notice? The most popular high-frequency outcome is no longer at zero. Because of compounding, the most likely outcome, purely statistics, is that it will be zero. If you're a retail investor and you're buying and holding an average company for 10 years, I'm sorry, it's not good news. You're most likely to lose money, if not lose all of it. And during this time, by the way, this 30-year period, the sample period, the share market, let's take the MSCI World, the widest possible market, was returning 5% a year. The market returns 5% a year for 30 years, but at the same time, a lot of shares, a lot of companies, a lot of issues were losing money. Either you're losing all of it or you're losing some of it. That is not a particularly good distribution. And look at the right-hand side. While that previous chart stopped at 400%, because of compounding, now you're doing it for 10 years, the great companies get bigger, stronger gets bigger again. You can see that right-hand side is phenomenal. And it is this right-hand side, this asymmetry, this ability to earn multiple times your money over a longer period of time, that drags up the average return for the market. And this is how you get to the market returning 5% a year while having so many companies going nowhere or going to zero. So as an investor, a research like this clearly focuses the mind on, well, how do I get to this right-hand side? we surely want as many companies in this group as we can get our hands on without knowing, you know, with certainty in advance, but at least a shot at it. So When we invest, we currently think about two things. Can we identify sectors or companies that are on a winning trend in a favorable environment? Because if you had 10 years of favorable environment, maybe it's conducive to this type of outcome where you're on a roll, you're getting stronger, you're getting bigger, you're doing more business, your profit margin starts to widen. And the second thing, beyond a very, very favorable sector tailwind, would be what are strong companies in that sector? So going back to the first point, can we identify long-term sustainable trends, tailwinds, things which are happening in the real world that is robust and consistent? And I don't think there is necessarily a more robust trend than the war that we're at. The war that never ends is something that we can benefit from in a way and take advantage of. And I don't mean this war, the trade war between US and China. That is a very relevant topic, but perhaps for another day. But the war I mean is this, the war against diseases, microbes, and to tie back to the COVID theme that's been running through this evening. You can see sort of antibodies surrounding an invading foreign virus. This is the war that I was talking about that is enduring, because even when COVID is gone, there could be something else. There's always cancer, Alzheimer's, all the diseases associated with the aging population are all very relevant. It is by no means just about infectious diseases. This is a very long-term structural area that's going to receive more attention, more money, and more business. So the company that we have in our portfolio that I'm going to talk to you tonight about is a U.S. company called Thermo Fisher. And Thermo Fisher is a $160 billion market cap company, so it's gigantic. It's got a very broad portfolio of products, including the tests that they're having to do for a positive or negative test on COVID. So this is the test they talk about. The official name is a PCR test. They make the machine and also the consumables, the reagents that you need, the preparation kits that you need to put your sample in and put it in the machine. They make all of those. And that is currently, obviously, in a very favorable spot. But not only that, I alluded to the very broad portfolio. They also make bioproduction vats. It needs to be very clean. Sometimes it's a single-use situation because you don't want to contaminate the product you're making. And this is all very relevant as we move forward, assuming we have viable vaccine candidates, they will need to be mass-produced. And this company sells the equipment and also the consumables that enable that. And this company is already very profitable. To my earlier point, if we want to end up on that right-hand side over the long term, you do need to have profits, and ideally you want to be able to reinvest those profits and continue to make the company bigger. And they're in that position currently. Now, I can't explain this company better than looking at one of their propaganda videos. So here's where I take a break, hopefully.
Almost half the world's population is in lockdown. The volume of confirmed cases has risen at a dramatic rate, and so has the number of fatalities. Novel coronavirus, or COVID-19, has spread across the globe with devastating effect. Thermo Fisher Scientific's scale and depth of capabilities have never been more vital, and our mission? To enable our customers to make the world healthier, cleaner, and safer has never been more important. But let's take a look back. The first case of COVID-19 was reported in Wuhan, China in December 2019. And we were there. On January 6th, our Thermo Scientific TechNi Spirit transmission electron microscope was used to characterize the pathogen. Over 1,200 boxes of our reagents and assays were then fast-tracked so researchers could rapidly develop tests. Meanwhile, scientists in Australia used our Applied Biosystems Seq Studio instrument to sequence the virus's genome and provide the roadmap for a diagnostic test. On January 30th, the World Health Organization declared a global emergency, and we were there. Our thermoscientific cryos electron microscope was used by a team of researchers from the US to show the first three-dimensional structure of the coronavirus spike protein, key to understanding how to target the virus. By February 19th, 14,000 new cases were reported in Hubei province, and we were there. In March, the World Health Organization declared COVID-19 to be a pandemic. Our real-time PCR test, which diagnoses the virus in 4 hours, was authorized by the US FDA for emergency use. It then received the CE mark in Europe, and now nearly 50 countries are authorized to use our test, which is based on our gold standard technology. As the virus spreads globally, we are producing more than 5 million of our COVID-19 diagnostic tests per week. At Thermo Fisher Scientific, we remain at the forefront of the fight against coronavirus. We're providing personal protective equipment to keep healthcare workers safe. We're modifying our production lines to make components for ventilators and produce hand sanitizer. We're partnering with pharma and biotech customers who are working on many of the top projects to develop COVID-19 treatments and vaccines. And that's just the start. There's a long way to go. But as one team, committed to our mission, we will prevail. We have much to be proud of.
So, as I pointed out earlier, we were invested in Thermo Fisher before the outbreak. And that's because we felt Thermo Fisher was effectively empowering our scientists. It was about equipping them with the tools that they need to push the frontier and push innovation. It so happens that we've also won effectively with this position as the COVID situation has really helped the demand for the rapid tests that they talked about. So Thermo Fisher in the second quarter this year, they just reported they show sales growth of 10%, which in this current climate, in this current environment, it's pretty good. Now, I want to make a reference to a local market company that my colleague in Milford covers and has a position in, and that's, of course, Fisher & Paykel. Now, they have world-class respiratory devices that is currently a frontline treatment for those who need it for COVID. Again, very similar. Not only do they sell a piece of kit, the equipment, they also sell a single-use consumable, the tubing that actually touches the patients, as you appreciate. There's no need to reuse that or trying to keep it for the next patients. That is a recurring need to buy new tubing and applications to go with the equipment to help ventilation, help breathing. And it's currently seeing very strong acceleration. So this is also another domestic life sciences beneficiary currently helped by the COVID pandemic. So here's a share price charts of how some of the life sciences companies that we have in the portfolio have done over the last 5 years. The first thing to point out is where the market, what the market has done over this period. It's in US dollars, so 7% is what the market has done on a per annum basis. And Thermo Fisher is this line here, compounding at 23% a year, so significantly higher than the market. And Danaher, which is another company in this area that we hold, very similar. And Intuitive Surgical, which is a robotic surgery company that we hold, even better, albeit a much more of a smaller niche, earlier stage company, less broad, less well established, grows faster, rewards investors that way. Here we have two very stable large platform companies with multiple products, so no real single product issue, performing very well and way better than the market. So to my point earlier on that right-hand side, want to leave the market behind. We've got to be involved with companies that are leaders in their space. We've got to have companies that are in a sector, in a space that is going to be benefiting long-term from structural trends such as aging population, need for healthcare, pushing the innovation envelope. And to round out the other aspects of the fund that I manage, I just spend time talking about transformational healthcare. We have other aspects of the fund that we're very equally excited and we also think fits that criteria long-term, such as digital transformation for businesses. Basically means the use of software in businesses, the use of software to collate, to manage, and to monitor work. We also have online shopping, which is, you know, again, a beneficiary from the virus pandemic. And we also have payment companies, which are pretty obvious examples of the world where we're all using plastic credit cards or even our phones to pay for things. We think these trends are very enduring, and almost no matter what happens to the GDP this year, next year we'll be doing the same behavior, same action all over again. So this is a graphical presentation of how I feel about these type of companies, a small subset of the market. These companies are truly extraordinary, and I'm obviously bullish on those. So to round out the last message I have for you as investors in the time of COVID, be selective. There's a very, very small part of the market that is worth buying and holding. The average company, you could make money on them if you were trading them, or if you're selling them at the right price, but that's pretty hard work. If you're simply a buy and hold investor, you've got to be extremely selective. And I'll suggest only world-class companies in favorable sectors. And here's how we've done. It's a real fund. It has fees on it. This is net of fees. The takeaway really is what the market's done, how we've done, and how we're comfortably better than the markets across all periods. This is a more graphical one. It's really about compounding and accumulating that performance over time. So in a longer dated series in our model portfolio, which doesn't have fees on it, so it's simply for tracking purposes, we are almost twice the returns of the market over the last 6 years. So that's consistent with the chart I showed you about what is possible, investing in shares, being very selective, and trying to get that right-hand side of the chart, of the tail, and that is a testament to how we've been putting that into practice. So with that, thank you very much. Happy to take questions.
Right. Ginny, question?
I note here that we've got a lot of, you know, if you hold a company for a while, you might get a better return. Is that why a number of companies from overseas or organisations are buying a number of our companies in New Zealand?
Hey, this will be company specific. Clearly, to the last part of my presentation, if it's a leading company in its own area and is profitable and there continues to be opportunities to invest more of its profits, of its capital, of its dividends back into the same business to grow it again, that is an extremely attractive company to hold for a long term. So absolutely, New Zealand does have a few of those. The more obviously, the better. Sometimes it's not necessary in the public markets, but it's a very company-specific point as a stock investor, as a share investor. It depends on that business, where it's placed, and whether it has leadership.
For the purpose of the question, assume that China prevails in Hong Kong. What do you see the impact on the investment environment?
Yeah, so that is going to be a more localized impact, I feel. Hong Kong obviously is a city with a lot of foreign interests. Multinational companies have bases there. But in the scheme of things, the issue will come down to whether U.S. investors will continue to feel comfortable, for example, investing and buying companies that are listed in Hong Kong. At this point, it's too early to say, but that would be the question mark.
just got one question. regarding the overall share market. The supports, government supports for unemployment and government stimulus, these look like they might continue in America and here, that they might be withdrawn or have a lot lesser form. And also I just notice in America that some of the money printing, you might as well say, or quantitative easing from the Federal Reserve seems to be feeding into the consumer price index and inflation is appearing. What's the likelihood in the next couple of years that we have inflation back and that these supports for unemployment aren't sustained and we have a contraction in just general consumer spending? What effect will this have on the market?
Yeah, that's certainly one scenario. I guess the purpose of the government spending is to tie the economy over until such a time lockdowns eased and people can get back to jobs. So you think about a political motivation, it isn't necessarily there to withdraw too early. Having started and having, you know, given support, it's often harder to withdraw that support. And the likelihood that is that people will wait. There will be some sort of continuation until the skies clear. But that is maybe the base case, but there is certainly a scenario where maybe due to a political process or political wrangling in the US that certain schemes are not rolled over in time. That's quite possible. But the motivation and the trend and the movement is pretty clear, and that is to save jobs, and that is to support businesses and individuals where possible. So I don't see that going on a U-turn. As regards inflation, it's very interesting. 10 years ago, sort of at the fallout from the global financial crisis, you know, did lead to this experimentation with money printing throughout the last decade. And every time that the QE spigots gets turned on, people starts talking about inflation. At some point, it should come back to roost, but it's not happened. And I won't say it won't happen, but the situation is, as I've shown, the world is clearly in a bad place. GDP down, and we're not likely to get genuine inflation until jobs are restored and economies start to grow again. You may get pockets of inflation in certain products where there's a supply disruption, quite possible. But broad-based inflation, that to the extent that people start to lose spending power and wages not able to keep up, I can't see that as a base case currently, but it's possible.
Yes, you advocating obviously quite strongly pick your stocks. We often hear commentators talking about just buying into indexed funds. How do you respond to that scenario or that different approach to investing?
So buying an index is an easy way to be invested. And your returns that I've shown in various charts will be probably mid-single digit. Because at the end of the day, it's limited by company profits growth. Now, if you buy a very broad-based index, you're going to get something in the middle. You're going to get average. And to the charts I showed, an index's returns is really generated by those same companies that are on the right-hand side of that tail. It's just that you own them in a smaller manner. In stock picking, if you like, the goal is to have more of those right-hand side companies, but in bigger proportions. Now, that clearly requires work and requires research, and that's why we're here. But for an individual, it's really a choice up to you how much time you want to spend and whether you have the appetite to play that game, to take that chance of being dramatically better than an index's returns or potentially worse. So that's an individual's decision.
Hi. So I know it's not your stock that you had Fisher & Paykel up there. Probably 4 or 5 years ago, trading on 15 times, I just looked, 70 times.
Right.
So I know interest rates have dropped, but how do you reconcile valuation in today's market?
So the technical answer is that you think about a company and its cash flows and its profits over a period of time. And that's not necessarily this year's earnings. So the 50 times would be the current share price divided by an earnings number this year. And the real question you have to ask with companies that are growing is, for how long can it grow at those sort of rates? Because if it can grow 10, 20%, before you know it, 5 years down the line, what you effectively is paying could be just 10 times, 20 times, the PE, the earnings in 5 years' time. And the company keeps growing after 5 years, you start looking pretty good. You start looking like a very low multiple. So there lies the question. You have to decide for yourself with these high earning company or high multiple companies, are they going to be profitable in future? And how long can those profits grow for? And that's what we spend, most of our daytime thinking about, day and night time thinking about, right?